Welcome back to Building Tomorrow, a podcast where we talk about how tech and innovation are making us healthier, wealthier, and wiser. Okay, maybe not wiser. I mean, we've all seen the caliber of intellectual that gets millions of followers and a blue check mark on Twitter these days. But today, Matthew Feeney and I are joined by a man wise in the ways of DC tech policy, Mr. Will Reinhart, the director of tech and innovation policy at the American Action Forum. Welcome to the show, Will.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Will, you have an extensive biography working on tech issues for various and sundry.
Yeah, about a decade now, a little over a decade, yep.
I mean, everything. Well, I saw Tech Freedom, Internet Law and Posse Foundry, Mercatus Center,
yep.
And some advisory boards for the FCC.
Yeah, advisory boards, the SEC, CAC. Formerly worked for an organization that... it was called the Progress and Freedom Foundation. It's kind of actually kind of how I got my start in all this. Was an intern, so I was a lowly intern in 2009. I was coming actually to this building right when it was finished and talking to other tech nerds. So yeah, I've been in this for a little while and have been studying and doing economic analysis, and that's kind of my background. So. Yeah, it's been an interesting decade so far.
So spending a decade in this kind of inside the Beltway tech policy locus, have you seen Congress, like your median congressperson over the course of those years, do they know more about tech now? Are they more tech savvy now than they were a decade ago? And maybe you can talk about like the preconceptions that the ordinary American Joe Blow public have about Congress people when it comes to technology.
Yeah, I think that just like anything else, there's a high amount of variability when it comes to congressional members relating to their knowledge and tech expertise. So I mean, I think there's probably a couple different ways to think about this. One is to obviously when you're talking to Congress members, you're not really talking to Congress members. You're talking typically to their staff, and staff typically do have a pretty decent knowledge and expertise of tech issues, generally speaking, I would say. I mean, especially because a lot of them are pretty young. The committees of jurisdiction that are important here, so like energy and commerce and typically judiciary, I think they're pretty well educated. And I've actually had a couple pieces on this and kind of thinking through if we really do need more tech expertise. And I tend to think that those committees of jurisdiction actually do a pretty good job, all things considered. But I'm also, when it comes to this kind of tech expertise, and I know there's been a lot of criticisms of Senator Lindsey Graham and I'm forgetting who else recently was criticized for some of this. But Michael Chabot was criticized for this recently. I think that one way to think about this kind of relationship between Congress and technology is also to realize that fundamentally congressional members and their staff are also very communication heavy as well, which I think is very, very important. So, when there's criticisms of Zuckerberg, people want, a very kind of astute, very narrow vision of what that tech, there is this kind of narrow vision of what that tech criticism from Congress should look like. And yet people often ask, Zuckerberg or, they'll ask, for example, Pichai, who is recently, this is Google's CEO, look at my Google rankings or my Facebook rankings. But I think that actually is evidence of a very important fact of Congress, which most people don't recognize, which congressional offices have this kind of dual role, which is not just technology and assessment and policy assessment, but also they're political actors who are using these tools. And so that's the reason why they care about these in kind of more mundane, like SEO type of ways. And that's search engine optimization, why they care about it from like a marketing perspective, which I think to a lot of young people, like, and millennials like myself, it really just feels weird that they're worried about these kind of placements within Google or placements within Facebook. But again, these are tools that they use. So these kind of these dual roles of both use, but also they see how those, how other actors are using their, using their visages and their like, their likeness online. So there's this more interesting pull and push with technology that is a little bit more complex than a lot of criticism, which is that just generally that congressional members aren't very educated.
And they feel like they can be pretty performative at times.
Very much so.
You're a senator. You want to seem like you know what you're talking about, but you don't want to seem too tech savvy. Because remember, your median voter, perhaps your median constituent donor, is going to be a little bit older. You know, like the whole kids these days thing plays well with your constituency.
Exactly.
So by saying stuff like, oh, my grandson was showing me what I did on the Facebook there, it's a way of – that's a performative playing to an audience. And
exactly.
So we see that as some people in our 20s and 30s and say these dunderheads don't know what they're talking about.
Exactly, yeah.
But they're doing a political performance, yeah.
Well, I do think part of the problem is that – when you say something like technology policy, you might as well be saying something like economic policy.
Yeah,
it's just such a huge, broad thing. So the meetings that I'm sure Will and I have will be staff who say, well, my boss wants to fix X problem or is worried about X, right? And that can be a whole plethora of things. But it turns out that, at least speaking for myself, you'll have people with humanities degrees sitting around a table in Washington with other typically other humanities degree people or lawyers. There aren't too many actual full-on technologists working in a lot of these staffs. And they're thinking a lot about law and policy. And I think that's a big challenge. And I know some people have discussed, well, one, should Congress and the government make a push to actually make sure that congressional staff can hire actual technologists, more computer scientists? And secondly, are we sure that would even make much of a difference?
Yeah. And these are two – I mean, this is a huge, huge question. This is something that I've been thinking about a lot recently, especially with this kind of push, especially in the last Congress for more tech expertise. And it seems also that this is going to be a big thing for the Democrats in the House this year. They have even, you know, in the original, the rules, which I think were just, which were the House rules, which I think were just adopted, I think yesterday,
right?
Yeah. Part of it includes this provision to basically modernize the tech element, or at least to modernize some tech elements of the House. So, I mean, there is this concern that perhaps some members don't have the technical expertise. I mean, there's two things I would mention about this, or at least one broad thing I would mention about this tech expertise issue. Is that the more that you get, I think that there is a worry by people who are thinking through this tech expertise. I mean, there's kind of a balancing act here. There is clearly worry that members probably don't have the technical computer science degrees when they're thinking through some of the legislation, and that does create a problem when you're actually writing real legislation that's going to be impacting these. But then again, I'm also of the nature that perhaps the fact that you don't actually know as much about the technology makes you a little bit more humble in what you're going to be able to do and your likeliness and your likelihood to regulate.
Humility on the Hill. This is
yeah. And then kind of with thinking through that, I mean, I don't know. I really don't know if I want to give congressional staff – I don't know that it's the best thing to give congressional staff all the expertise in the world to understand how to prohibitively regulate every single technology that they encounter. That to me seems to be a bit of a problem. And again, we don't see this with every single technology anyway. You know, you do have some congressional staff who know a lot about, for example, you know, like oil and energy, but you don't have you don't have petrologists on staff, you know, doing that kind of work as well. So I don't know. I there's this push and pull for me on these issues. And I one of my big things for 2019 is to not succumb to binaries that say we need X or Y or that good, you know, that this thing is good or bad. You can have both elements of the same thing. So the push for tech expertise, I think we should also recognize that the more tech expertise that you get, there may be some beneficial outcomes, but there's also probably likely to be some pretty negative outcomes, which means more legislation and the things that I think could be very detrimental, especially to permissionless innovation, which I think is a big key thing that is going to be a key issue in 2019.
So you mentioned that mentioned the word yesterday. We should note that we're recording this on January 4th. Yeah.
Yes.
So
yes.
The new Congress was, or the House was sworn in yesterday.
Yes.
So Will, what's looking at the incoming new folks in the House, and also the people who have left.
Yep.
What does the incoming class mean for innovation and technology policy broadly? Have some of these new people said anything interesting, or is it too early to tell?
I think it's a little bit too early to tell. For various reasons, I seem to have been following a lot more with what's happening in the Senate, just because it seems like some of the senators have been a little bit more outspoken on some of these. You know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I always forget.
Cortez.
I'm sorry. I always, again, we were just joking about this. I always see her as AOC now. So I'm
the
always
AOC.
Like, yeah. She seems to be pretty, or at least interested in doing some
dancing.
Well, also some, she wants to probably regulate big tech giants. So, you know, that type of element seems to exist within a lot of new House members, and in the same way that you've seen some of the old, you know, leadership also within the Senate and in the House. You know, you've seen a lot of the mentions of potentially regulating technology companies, and that's a pretty broad, again, as we kind of laid out here, that includes a whole bunch of different things, which I know we're going to get into. There is, hopefully, however, there is some positive things from the new Congress, which is that, you know, that we do have a bit of a younger, at least in the House side, we do typically have a bit of a younger element, which I think could be a little bit more interesting. That could turn out kind of bad in the sense that there is kind of a bit of a, you know, especially for our generation, there's a little bit more negativity towards these kinds of tools than I think is probably warranted. But there's just generally, it seems, a bigger appetite for the first time in really the majority of the time that I've been working in this space. There's, I feel like this Congress, there really is just a bigger appetite to do something and really anything on tech. And that includes a lot, you know, privacy and AI regulation and a whole bunch of other spaces and, you know, broadband. It just seems, perhaps because a lot of the other low-hanging fruit has already been picked, but also that it seems to be much more of an issue, a topic at hand, especially regulating tech companies.
I'd like to get your thoughts on what I think many Americans view as the biggest tech news of the last year, especially as it relates to Congress. So many people remember that the CEOs of the big tech giants were hauled before different committees for hearings, and these big tech giants have been at the forefront of debates that seem to be happening about, namely, so-called censorship, right? But also antitrust is another thing, and this is actually, I think, raised a really interesting opportunity to talk about the legislation that allows the internet to work as we know it. Will, could you actually explain to listeners who might have been in headlines heard of Section 230, which seems to get discussed all the time, what is that, what does it do, and why does it seem to be cropping up so often in these kind of conversations?
Yeah, so Section 230 is actually a specific section of what was called the Communications Decency Act, which I think was either 1995 or 1996. I always forget this one. I think it is 1996. So CDA, and it's literally CDA Section 230, was part of a bigger legislative package that really came about because of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And so these two acts kind of came together, and Communications Decency Act itself had actually a lot of elements of effectively, you know, controlling various elements of the internet to make it more family friendly. And a lot of that was basically kicked out at the Supreme Court level in a series of really important cases. But what's since kind of has survived is this Section 230, which is a which basically it limits the liability of these platforms, these large platforms, to any, you know, content that is going on their network. Originally, it seems it meant really to apply to ISPs, but the way that it's written, it seems to apply to ISPs and content providers. I mean, it does apply to both ISPs and content providers. And really what it was allowed and meant to do is really to these network providers, both ISPs effectively and kind of these large content players that we now know as Facebook and Twitter and Google, it allows them to do a bit of editing and but also doesn't necessarily require them to go after every single element of potentially, you know, nefarious content that's going through their networks, which, you know, there's some interesting elements obviously that I think could change in this next Congress. I should say that this, and it's generally considered, it's called a, you know, an intermediary it's an intermediary liability such that the network itself is not liable for the content that's going across the network. That, however, isn't absolute, though, and it should be noted that there are a lot of carve-outs to that. You know, copyright is carved out from it so that you can't, you know, they have due diligence. They're required to do due diligence on these copyrighted elements. You know, recently there was a change to the law that effectively allowed, you know, these content that potentially could be used for sex trafficking. And this was, you know, FOSTA SETSA last year. So there are some carve outs to the law themselves. But there's a kind of a bigger, broader question about CDA Section 230 and whether or not we should generally change it. And, you know, it's potentially a big operational change.
Yeah, I think it's perhaps worth noting that these kind of discussions on 230 have emerged out of debates about interference in our elections. People are upset yeah. about bots. And mm-hmm. I believe one of the original drafters, or at least supporters of 230, Senator Ron Wyden, has actually expressed openness to this kind of mm-hmm. Stuff. And I don't think it's hyperbolic to say that Section 230 really does allow most of what we view as social media to exist. I mean, I think what Will's saying, maybe an example would be good. So if you post illegal or harmful content on your Facebook wall, Facebook can't be sued or have action taken against them because of that, which is different than if Will wrote something libelous in a newspaper.
Yeah,
that would be a different kind of proceeding. Is that right? Is that?
Yeah, generally speaking, though, there is a lot of case law that comes into play here. So this isn't I would say that generally speaking, that's correct. However, there's a lot of case law that goes behind this, which, I mean, if you would really want to do an in-depth review, I would suggest that would be actually a really interesting podcast. I, however, am not a lawyer, a Section 230 lawyer, but that space is, you know, the big question I think that people are trying to grapple with right now is whether or not certain kinds of effectively state law torts, which exist out there right now, like defamation, false light, public disclosure of private facts, if those type of things should get not a carve out, but should also now be included, such that the large providers, the large, you know, intermediaries, as they're known, they should be effectively liable or have to, you know, have some element of taking this type of content down. There's also, I think, kind of an interesting, again, there's other interesting potential carve outs. One of them would, and I know that this has been talked about, is something related to opioid, the opioid epidemic. So if there's kind of, you know, any material, I forget exactly how this bill would be defined, but the conversation basically is, well, you know, we obviously have these opioid problems. It seems that a lot of this happens in online spaces where you kind of have suggested advertisements from some doctors. It may happen, for example, in some, you know, groups within, say, for example, Facebook or Twitter, or even, you know, on Google, you know. And so the idea is then to attack the opioid problem through that by making it such that these platform providers have to kind of go after these, you know, some of these, what it seems like there's online opioid, I don't want to say peddlers, mm-hmm. but something along those lines. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of conversation about changing this. I don't know. I don't really see. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting cases that are related to this that are that test really the waters on a lot of Section 230 issues. Generally, I think that the fact that platforms haven't really been required to be liable on a lot of these things has led to a general flowering of the internet and has, you know, increased content pretty dramatically and has given America its own kind of has given America really a leg up in this. I also really do worry because having spent a number of years, you know, and I've, you know, done enough traveling to Europe and talked to enough people in the UK to know that, you know, a lot of times when you're talking about these defamation lawsuits, it really is, you know, there's some really unfortunate cases in Italy and some unfortunate cases in Germany that some of these defamation cases are far more political in nature. So it really kind of undermines, you know, political conversations and kind of, you know, the political free flowing of thought. So I don't know. There's a conversation to be had here about Section 230, but I also really do worry about our efforts to try to get rid of the censorship problem or try to, you know, root out the censorship problem through Section 230 modifications.
I think our first article for the Building Tomorrow column that we have on L.org was about Sesta Fosta and the unintended ill consequences that this was on the front end, right before, right as it was passing.
Yep.
And the concern was we're going to puncture a new hole in Section 230. And there already were some carve-outs for copyright and whatnot.
Yeah.
But a lot of content moderation beyond copyright was frowned upon. The idea was that if we make an exception and say, well, because we're so worried about sex trafficking, we're going to weaken this kind of protection for platforms. Well, what will be – it sets a precedent. People will start arguing for other carve-outs.
Yep.
And then also the unintended ill consequences. We've already seen a lot of that come to light. It doesn't look like it's been very effective at actually combating sex trafficking. And it's been very effective at basically removing prostitutes from advertising online, shutting down forums that prostitutes use, which then actually shoves them into a black market, which they're more likely to be out on the street rather than, you know, advertising online. So lots of ill consequences on that end. But I think the concern here, I mean, I think it's interesting to bring up proposals for new carve-outs. I mean, we're already seeing that in possibly in 2019 that, well, because in Sesta Fosta we punctured a hole in 230, why not do so for opioid dealers online? And if that goes, why not this? Why not that? Why not? You know, I mean, you can see the kind of slippery slope.
Yeah, I mean, Senator Joe Manchin has suggested this. Incoming Senator Josh Hawley has said that we need to kind of take a new look at Section 230 and concerns about deplatforming. Senator Ben Sasse, for being an interesting senator, and I think, you know, he often provides kind of a sometimes a balancing act. He himself has also suggested that perhaps we should be talking about deplatforming as well. So, or that, you know, what this relationship between Section 230 and deplatforming and really what can be done, at least at the federal level. So, Ben had had an op-ed about this not too long ago. I'm fairly certain. I think it was in the on NRO. But yes, there is this. I mean, there is a very real, you know, oftentimes the slippery slope fallacy isn't really particularly great to go down. But I actually do think this is one of the few cases where we're seriously talking about changing this kind of fundamental law. Also at the same time, I mean, not just to say too much about, you know, Republicans like Josh Hawley and Ben Sasse, but, you know, again, Manchin and Mark Warner has also talked a little bit about this. So his white paper that had a long list of potential regulatory bills, which was, I think it was like 15 pages and included something like 20 potential regulatory bills that could be out there, which was just to me a little shocking. But he also talks very much about this, about perhaps, you know, state torts. And as I mentioned kind of earlier, perhaps state torts should have carve outs here within Section 230. So it is a really important thing to be watching for this year.
But the Warner paper, if I recall, was it sometime over the summer, right? August?
Yes.
August,
yeah, right? Yeah.
And but some of it was just, it seems to me, just unworkable given the Constitution of the United States. Like this sort of the introduction of something like a European right to be forgotten. Yeah. And of course, the staff will say, look, hey, we're just toying with ideas here. And maybe it's worth, I think it would be good to get Will's thoughts on all of this talk about what we've been discussing. Are solutions to problems, right? Some that might be imaginary and some that might be actual, right?
So, yes. What are the,
Right. So some people are concerned about these big tech companies are monopolies. People are worried that these tech companies are violating our privacy. Some people are worried that these big companies, for all intents and purposes, are the public forum and are censoring whole swaths of the American political commentariat.
Yep.
So we've talked a little bit about the regulatory pushes that some members have, but are they swinging at ghosts here, or I don't know what the metaphor I'm looking for is, but are these actual problems that Congress should be dealing with?
That's never stopped Congress.
In 30 seconds or less. Yeah.
Are these problems? That's never really stopped Congress from trying to to enact policy and legislation based on perceived problems. I mean, you hit on at least three different ones here. One of them was, the monopoly question, which I think is really big. Another one is this privacy question. And then another one is obviously this public forum, which I think kind of relates to the question of censorship, just generally speaking. The monopolies, I've written a lot about the question of monopolies. They're I'm 2 weeks, I'm going to do a talk about this question of monopolies. It's really a difficult question when you look at least some of these major platforms, when you're talking about monopolies in the traditional sense, because typically when you look at monopolies, okay, you're looking at a monopolist who is raising prices to effectively decrease input. You don't really have too much, when you're talking about a platform, on one side of the platform, you really don't have any prices per se.
Right.
So
Facebook's
really,
free.
Yeah. Facebook and Google are free and Twitter is free. So you don't really have the traditional monopoly problem. And then you get to, well, okay, but there's only effectively a single provider in each of these, in each of these spaces. But then you ask, okay, well, then if there's only a single provider, then what you're actually competing on is advertising, for example. So perhaps the monopoly industry is advertising. But, there's good reason to believe that and there's some really interesting NBER research on this, that, the more effectively when it comes to online platforms. So first off, you have to consider the fact that online advertising is not the only version of advertising. There's, TV advertising, radio advertising, newspaper advertising. It's dwindling, but it's still there. So you look at all advertising, okay, still, I forget the percentage, but it's still not the absolute majority. And even if when you are considering still digital advertising, it's still the question is, well, okay, does the current structure increase prices and decrease the benefit to the other side? Is there some kind of impact to the consumer of advertising that we can solve? And when you start asking questions of remediability, what is the problem of advertising that we're trying to solve within this bigger monopoly question? That again is not really an easy answer, because the more concentrated a platform is, the more information you have about all of the users. And because you have because you've effectively solved this kind of weird asymmetry problem, you actually do have better advertising prices for a more and broader platform. I can send this report to you guys if you're interested. Yeah. I actually was very, very intrigued by this series.
Put a link in the notes.
And so the monopoly question is not easy. It's not an easy question. And I don't want to take too long on this point, but the FTC has been grappling with this question of, well, what does monopoly really look like in kind of these big platform providers? I think they're now on their, I want to say like eighth or ninth of these hearings, but they spent the majority of 2018, and I, was watching a lot of them, going through these hearings and asking, okay, what are the monopoly questions that we're talking about with these large platform providers? And it's not clear. It's really as clear as I think we would hope. And then the other problem is, well, what do you do about it?
Well, and to that question, we had Mike Masnick from TechDirt come on a couple episodes ago, and the irony is that sometimes efforts to combat this perceived monopoly can actually backfire and entrench monopoly. So he noted like the EU's digital copyright scheme, which among other things, whether you call it link tax or not, part of the intent was to take power from or kind of market share from big aggregators like Google when it comes to showing like Google News and clips and links to articles, and trying to shift that like digital advertising market back down to the papers themselves, to online papers. But the net effect of the rules, even in the few short months since the rules have been proposed and as parts of it has been passed by the EU, has been to actually shift more power to Google. It's actually the thing meant to, you know, erode their monopoly has actually empowered this monopoly.
Yes.
And so it, we have to be cautious when we get into questions of like, how can you try to regulate against natural monopoly? Are you just going to end up fueling the beast? And it's an open question. I mean, what's been proposed here? So we've had hearings in Congress, and they've drug a bunch of reluctant CEOs in front of them, and it all makes for, I guess, I don't know if decent television, but it's made for television content. What's actually being proposed? I mean, like, what are they talking about doing? I mean, so far it's just been a bunch of show.
Probably the most important piece and probably the one. So there's a couple when we're talking about privacy legislation and it should be noted there's a bit of a, even though these are obviously very associated, I think it is important to kind of separate out this privacy question and privacy concerns, which really are, you know, GDPR and CCPA, which is the California Consumer Privacy Act. You know, those types of pieces of legislation really need to be separated from these larger kind of antitrust questions, even though when we talk about antitrust and monopolies, the big tech platforms tend to get, you know, just kind of thrown in that bucket. Now, obviously, we haven't seen a lot of legislation yet because we're currently the second day of the new Congress.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Give them time.
Of course. But there were a couple pieces of legislation that came out towards the end of last year and throughout the 115th Congress, which was the last Congress. Senator Brian Schatz had a bill which was called the Data Care Act of 2018. That, I think, was as far as the overall pieces of legislation that have the possibility of passing. That, even though I think it does have some problems, that does have pretty broad buy-in. There's about 15 different senators who have bought into this. So there's 15 different co-sponsors. I want to say that it is bipartisan with the co-sponsorship, but don't quote me on that. Schatz has really shown himself to be hugely important in this space. He's, you know, a senator. I find him and his staff pretty knowledgeable about these issues. And while I disagree, I think that that piece of legislation, the Data Care Act of 2018, is probably among the most important to be watching. So, there's a couple things it does, but the main thing it does is it creates this new set of duties. So that creates a duty of care, duty of loyalty, and then a duty of confidentiality. And the even though he doesn't say it within the piece of legislation, the name for this is called an information fiduciary. And this is an idea that a law professor named Jack Balkin has been pushing for quite some time. And Tim Wu has been pushing, and Jonathan Zittrain have been talking about this idea of an information fiduciary. So this is really, I think, probably the first piece of legislation that really exemplifies that. Again, this is on the Senate side. The other one that it has problems. It's another important bill to be watching is the Browser Act, because we're still waiting to see how it kind of separates out. But it seems as though Senator Blackburn, who was previously last Congress a representative, is now a senator. She is probably going to be in the judiciary. And that means it looks like she'll probably be pushing the Browser Act within the Senate. The Browser Act really creates a lot of opt-in requirements for data collection and kind of goes towards more of like an opt-in data collection realm. So it's a little bit, so while Schatz's bill is a little bit more focused on these kind of information fiduciaries and creating these new duties, you know, duty to care for, like I said, duty to care, duty to loyalty, and duty to confidentiality, hers is a little bit more focused on these kind of opt-in and data collection questions. So it's a little bit of a different perspective and a little bit of a different approach to each one of them. And of course, there are some other senators. And again, a lot of this work has been done in the Senate so far, just because, you know, they have been thinking about this for a little bit longer. And also there just hasn't been as much mix up in the leadership. But there's also it seems like there's also a bill coming from Wicker and Senator Wicker and Senator Blumenthal. So that would be bipartisan legislation as well. That, you know, some of these proposals really do worry me pretty extensively, because I think the real big impact, which is what you've seen in GDPR, is an entrenchment of the biggest players, because it creates, as one of your colleagues, Julian Sanchez, said, you know, it's a consent monopoly. It really does require these platforms, or it requires the entire system to be run on consent, that you have to have opt-in approval, that, you know, you have to say, yes, I want this to happen to my data. And because the biggest players are the ones who can consistently get that consent, they're the ones who have access to the information, whereas the new entrants, the people who potentially could come in and kind of disrupt those big tech providers, really are going to face bigger hurdles. So there are clear impacts to these laws if they actually do get passed.
There's also the so-called Internet Bill of Rights that's been proposed by, I guess, Congressman Khanna, right?
Yes.
That includes some of this opt-in stuff. But and given that the Democrats now have the House, do you think we'll see movement on those kind of proposals?
The two things that at least on the tech front that the Democrats have talked pretty extensively about are broadband development and rural broadband development. At least this is what they've said to some of the media that I follow pretty closely. So, you know, the two big things are just rural broadband development question, and then the other one is privacy and just doing something on privacy. So the end package, I think, is going to be interesting to see, because it could kind of combine a lot of these efforts. It could take a little bit from the, you know, from the Browser Act and sort of the opt-in approvals. It could take a little bit from the information fiduciaries. It could take a little bit of these the Bill of Rights from Rep Khanna and kind of, you know, mix them all together and see, you know, kind of create an American version of the GDPR, which I know that a lot of people want. There's obviously a lot of problems with some elements of the GDPR. But there's also a lot of organizations and advocacy organizations who are really pushing for a comprehensive, as they call it, a comprehensive baseline legislation that effectively creates one law to rule them all.
Which, that's not ominous.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah. You know, in the what we're faced with on the other side is a very real deadline, which we haven't really mentioned at all, and I've kind of hinted at, which is California. California has a law, it has CCPA, it has really the first privacy law proposed by any state in the United States. It will come into effect in 2020, so the beginning of 2020. So we have potentially 1 year to do something federally. There's really big problems with that law itself, just in definitions. It's about 10,000 words long. It's among the most complicated pieces of legislation I've ever seen. It's pretty poorly written they've already had, I think that about every, so it was passed in June. Yeah, let me see here. My notes say June 28th, CCPA was passed. Within a month or within 2 months, there was two major amendments that were passed to it. And they've been passing amendments and like proposing various amendments because of just, I think, clearly how poorly it's written and how it's really not been thought through. And we'll see. I mean, there is, unfortunately, there is an appetite for other cities. New York City has said that they want to create their own privacy. So it means New York City would have privacy and California would have privacy. We'd assume probably Hawaii would probably do this. Illinois, you know, my home state, would probably do this.
Who's going to be able to keep up with this patchwork of privacy laws?
Yeah.
Again, it's big incumbents,
yep,
and the small insurgents are going
to
have
exactly
a hard time.
Exactly. The big players will be able to do something. They'll be able to deal with it, I think, pretty. Yep. Not easily. They'll have to spend a lot of money to deal with it, but they have the money to deal with it.
The competitive advantage, though.
Exactly. Over, yeah. But it also affects a whole bunch of industries that you wouldn't think that would be included. So like retail would be included in this. You know, Walmart would be included in things like this, and basically anyone that's doing any work on data at all, any company that does any. Stores any information related to data.
Who doesn't? I mean, right?
Yeah, that's what I don't think that it's consumers crazy. And people who are really pushing for this understand that if you're in a modern business context, every single company has some sort of data, and if you have to abide by all of the potential regulations that or I shouldn't say potential regulations, because we really don't know. You know, I want to say this, that I was talking to a company, and they said that, you know, they don't know if they can even, you know, I'm not going to say who they are, but they said they don't even really know if they can comply with this. They'll be defensible, but they don't know if they can comply because the law itself can't be complied with. It's just that there's so many conflicts within the law that you can't even comply with it.
Wow.
You can't do two things at the same time. So they'll be defensible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a lot of companies are looking to be, is defensible, but not compliant. And that's, I think that's a big, big issue.
There's a lot of lawyers who become really wealthy defending those.
It's, of course, a whole bunch of lawyers who helped to write the law in California, and a whole bunch of the, you know, the class action lawsuits, which are a big, big question within California, because it kind of opens up the door to pretty huge class action lawsuits, which, of course, the plaintiffs bar really, really likes. So, yeah, there's this opens up a really, to me, a very worrisome bag of worms that I really just, I hope we kind of deal with. And federal legislation is probably going to have to be, unfortunately, the way that we deal with it.
So I think our listeners are going to share a lot of those apprehensions. And we have been very focused on social media, online platforms, kind of that's been our tech focus here in the conversation so far. But I'm also interested in picking your brain, Will, about potential overlap. So if you're a libertarian just libertarian loving listener to this show, what aspects of overlap are there with a newly empowered, like Representative Khan is a very progressive a representative, and there's going to be a greater willingness to regulate things coming out of this tech regulation, out of this Congress? Are there areas of overlap where you can see kind of more libertarian leaning folks and tech progressives like Khanna and others, where we share interests? Maybe this isn't online digital content, but it's, I don't know, driverless cars or encryption or drones. Or are there areas where we can see stuff that libertarians can say, that's good regulation on the horizon that we can work across the kind of ideological divide on?
Yeah, I think that, that generally speaking, the goals are I think that for a lot of progressives, that the end goal is innovation. Now, I think there's a big disagreement between, you know, effectively, I don't want to do this as an us and them, but between us and them on how we get there. I'm hesitant in the general communication, advanced communication and tech space. I think that the history of tech regulation really speaks to the problems of this kind of regulatory solutionism. And I do see a lot of people on, you know, that consider themselves on the left, or, you know, would be considered, you know, leftists or progressives, that who really do kind of, you know, ultimately believe in that, that, you know, that smart regulations really, really, really can, you know, create better outcomes. But, you know, there are other countries, and I think that the big thing to look at is countries, and especially I think the European Union really is kind of the big foil to the United States in this, there's again, the European Union provides an example of what the kind of the solutionism, the regulatory solutionism mindset really gets you. So I think that we generally agree that we want innovation, and that we want, you know, we want kind of a robust civic society, and that we all agree that we want, you know, that we want to generally empower people with technology. I think there is a very big and divergent view, and I hope that people would understand there's a big and divergent view between between those two places when it comes to the means to doing it. I would much rather see, you know, perhaps more transparency, so you know you have disclosure over the kind of information that is generally collected. I'm not particularly opposed to those sorts of things, you know, transparency about what is being known about you. But at the same time, when you do look at how consumers interact online, they tend to go towards these larger platforms, because the larger platforms actually do give them the access and the ability to change around their privacy settings. So, you know, kind of one of the best and underreported polls came from Reuters last year that found that something like 75% or, you know, almost 80% of all people actually do know their privacy settings and do know how to access it, but they don't really do that. And that's because these large platforms are actually, there's a lot of opportunities to go in and kind of change around your information. A lot of people don't do it, and a lot of people do actually do this, but making that more complicated, I don't think necessarily gets you to a better world. And there's also this big question, which again has been hinted in this conversation about the First Amendment, which is that one of the big problems with baseline privacy legislation is something that Eugene Volokh has talked about in probably one of the most important papers, which is that limiting the right of a platform to speak about you is a First Amendment violation. And it is, a lot of the privacy legislation is going to have to come up against the First Amendment. And that's also something that I think that if you're more, more liberty minded, that you really need to do, you probably need to be thinking about, well, wait a second, the fact that these privacy legislations, even if you do believe in kind of curtailing the largest platforms, these privacy legislations privacy proposals rather might actually kind of undermine this important right to free speech that really does need to be upheld. So this is going to be an interesting year, and it's going to be a weird year. And unfortunately, I think it's going to be for people who are in this space, for myself included, I think it's going to be kind of a bad year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, on that note, I thought we could do a whole other podcast. Glad to have you back on this. The privacy paradox that you've just mentioned, because I could talk for England on privacy and tech. But I think there'll be plenty of other opportunities. I do think that we need to be careful when we're talking about privacy and tech of not assuming the right kind of privacy that people should want or have, and thinking actually, you don't even know how bad this is going to be. So let us step in and restrict the amount of information you're sharing. It's much better to, I think, have it on control. Paul, I don't know if you wanted to.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great place to leave this. We'll have to have you back on, Will. Thanks for coming on.
Of course,
Even though
by the way, I'm a huge fan of this podcast, so it's actually really fun to be on it.
That's great to hear. Yeah, yeah, we'll have to have you on again. And this is a never drying up well of content
ending.
Here, right? Never ending. And we should do a special. We should do something because, like, as if the EU is the foil to the US often on matters of tech regulation. Man, the shit show that is civil liberties and digital civil liberties that is Great Britain now is a real mess. Yeah.
And it's huge impact and investment in the space. I mean, there's really good, even early evidence on how this has affected the internet ecosystem in the EU, that it's actually seriously suffered in the last two quarters because of it. So, yeah. Good for them.
That's right. Well, and on that note, until next week, be well. Thanks for listening. Building Tomorrow is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Building Tomorrow, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.